This is Internet Marketing. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 163 of Internet Marketing, brought to you by Site Visibility at sitevisibility.com. And in today's show, Kelvin discusses the role of online PR in SEO with independent online marketing consultant Chris Lee. All coming up in Internet Marketing.
So I'm joined on the line by Chris Lee, who's kind of an independent online marketing consultant, who is going to be joining us at Brighton SEO and delivering one of the workshops. Now, the workshop that Chris is going to be leading is kind of making the connection between online PR and SEO. And it's kind of really aimed at people who are perhaps link builders, but feel that they could learn more from the world of public relations and PR. Do you think that that's kind of a fair assessment, that actually most people, Chris, who have got experience of building links could probably improve their success on Google by understanding more about public relations?
I think they absolutely could. I mean, look at the authority of a lot of news sites like The Guardian, The Telegraph, possibly, and Daily Mail, of course, on the, you know, the most read of all media. Not only that, I mean, you're looking beyond national papers towards the authority of local and vertical papers for, you know, more long tail search, perhaps localized search. And then also let's not forget the importance of bloggers, which are getting more and more important, where kind of the lines between SEO and PR have been blurred time. I don't think that either side has quite nailed it yet. There are a few, if you look at the Venn diagram between the two, there are a few very successful agencies, very progressive agencies that have conquered that ground so far and doing a very good job. But actually, if you look at it from a PR perspective, and I've like 13 years PR experience in the tech space, if I talk amongst peers and see what they're doing, apart from those really digital savvy, they're all concerned with generating good coverage, and that's what their clients are demanding on the whole. But what doesn't resonate is getting that second benefit of online, which is you know, the links back and competing for keywords. It's not something that's culturally factored in that much. I think a lot of PR firms on the whole seem to be talking a good game. How much do they actually understand about SEO is another question. Now, the opportunity for SEOs here is that they can start making a march into this ground, and if they don't, I'm afraid the PR industry is going to be very quick to gobble. We had last February at Brighton SEO. Was it February? When was it?
I think it was April 1st last year.
There you go. The time does, but it's it was. I remember that saying like SEO needs to grow up and needs to become more like PRs. And I think that PR does have that sort of reputation outside of its own industry, where it's like, oh, is it fluffy? Is it a dark art of some description? No, it's not. It's a really essential part of the marketing machine, and it's something you can't avoid doing, really. You want to have good relationships with press and other influential publishers, such as bloggers. Then you need to know how to build relationships with them, build up trust in the long term, and you know, get your materials and your clients, and thusly their keywords in front of these people, so that they, when they write about them, are generating really good authoritative and diverse links back to your domain.
And what do you think, Chris, in terms of is some of the things that someone who's used to coming at kind of this online PR link building overlap from a SEO perspective, what do you think are some of the challenges that they're going to find that, you know, most difficult to deal with, that potentially would come second nature to someone who comes from a PR background?
I think it's, you have to become salespeople, basically. This is a really sort of important facet of being a PR person, is you've got to be able to sell, not just with your voice, either on the telephone if you're pitching to a journalist, but also in the way you write your emails and making sure that relevance is key. That's, you've got about 5 seconds to impress a journalist on email before they delete your trash, you know, and if you spam these people, you could end up being blacklisted and they're going straight to junk, and they'll never know you existed either. So it's kind of really delicate balance, the act of long-term relationship building, slightly bit of a sales job, but in the end, that when you, if you do it right, especially with, you know, bloggers as well, then the accolades are So the benefits are multiple.
And in terms of kind of building that relationship, because I think that's the big sea change that I'm seeing in the world of searches, that there's less of a kind of who do I need to contact to get a link now for this client, for this project, then that's the end, to more of a kind of how can I build a relationship that lasts over a period of time that means that I can benefit my client on this occasion and again in 6 months' time and another completely different client at another point in time. Is there kind of any advice that you can offer to people in terms of how do you manage that relationship with a journalist when potentially there's a bit of a conflict there? Because what you want is you want your clients to get coverage, but what they want is potentially, I think most journalists realise that public relations people are there to help them, but sometimes it can be a fraught relationship sometimes, can't it? And I can imagine link builders who are perhaps not quite so used to that tense relationship a greater risk, potentially, I would have thought.
Well, that's the funny thing. I mean, it's journalists, you quite often find them posting blog posts about how bad, you know, they've had an approach from a PR about, or complaining, you know, about a particular firm or whatever it happens to be. There's always been this kind of like love-hate relationship with between PRs and journalists, but at the end of the day, they're totally interdependent. You know, PR just gives journalists, especially currently, given that they are far more desk-bound than they used to be, they're under pressure to produce more content than ever, and that's a great opportunity for SEOs because there's a lot of copy and pasting that goes on. Yeah. And the other point is that I think journalists understands that and appreciates a really good PR. So as long as you're not, when I said earlier about being a salesperson, what I mean is you don't sell in terms of, hey, buy this, blah, blah, blah. You know, you need to be more subtle about things again and always consider a journalist or a blogger's audience, because that's who they're writing for. At the end of the day, they're not interested that your client has won an award for X, Y, and Z. What they really want to know is what impact the product or service that your client may have won an award for is going to have on their readers. You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, and is it about crafting a story to a certain extent, or just kind of help them? So in fact, rather than a here's our piece of news, which I suppose is the temptation to maybe go to, actually, here's how we or my client fits part of this bigger story or this bigger pattern. Is that a good way of thinking about it? You know, actually you're trying to get coverage for yourself, but actually it's about something bigger and you're just a small part of that bigger story, but you benefit from that bigger story being written about and spoken about.
Well, I mean, the key is that I think for a lot of brands, they get kind of sucked into themselves, if that makes sense, and kind of forget that there's a world out there who isn't spending 24/7 thinking about that particular brand, and they really need to sort of step outside and take a look from the outside in and say, okay, then why would anyone be interested in hearing this messaging from this particular company? You know, what's in it for them? At the end of the day, if there's no interest for the reader, then there's no interest for the journalist. So you're wasting everyone's time and budget. So, I mean, things that work really well, obviously, like surveys, but they are everyone's doing survey nowadays. But as long as you can add some really good intelligence on the back of it, not just have some sort of tenuous link. So it's almost worth just saving up really good, you know, good projects, and then just sort of like doing it that way, you know, having five massive major projects every quarter rather than throwing out press releases every week, which is what some people do and think that the more we throw out, the more coverage you'll get, which is absolutely not true. In fact, the converse is probably correct, because over familiarity can breed contempt.
Yeah. And in terms of things like surveys, just a recommendation for the listeners out there, there's a good tool that we've used in the past for our clients called Taluna, which is kind of a pretty cost-effective way of going out and surveying 250 people to find out what they think about whether Torres was too expensive or something like that. Have you got kind of any advice in terms of when you're putting together those surveys or carrying them out, things to think about to increase the likelihood of when you do pitch that to a journalist that or a blogger that they're gonna go for it? And I mean, I know it'll be different on a case by case basis, but any kind of general things you try to recommend?
I think it'd be timeliness is really important. There's nothing worse than putting together a survey and then the day you put it out, suddenly find that Apple have got a massive announcement going on and that you've been, and all the journalists are at that event. So, I mean, you've got to be really sure that there's some quiet time. That's why things like summer are quite good for silly surveys, they call it silly season, and also the period running up to Christmas. The other thing to consider is your actual audience field. If you're doing purely consumers, you need
serious thousands to actually make it valid. If you're doing specialists, then you need less of those. But these are survey houses will charge different amounts for access to those individuals they've got on their database. So I think what we really need to be clear about before engaging on a survey is how you're going to end-to-end, not just sit there thinking, well, let's see what findings are before we do anything. You'll think, okay, we're going to build a report about this. How are we going to make that available? How to capture data, if we're going to make it available online, all that sort of thing. I'll be doing an example at my presentation at Brighton SEO on the 12th of April into one example of where a survey for a particular client was very, very successful and led to a load of inbound links and excellent coverage. So, yeah, people that attend my workshop can look forward to that.
And in terms of, you know, like once you've got that data, have you found kind of, and this is, I think, an area it's headed, and we were kind of talking about this before we started recording the call, in terms of producing that into kind of visuals can be quite a good way of, you know, providing it so it's easy for someone to embed in a blog post or that type of thing.
Infographics rock. I mean, you know, I think it's important to give people, the benefit of giving it journalists that they've got something they can then publish and use it or embed into their online publishing. But then two, you've got a bit of link bait there to sit in your own web and draw people in. So infographics, very simple, easy way to present your data. And then obviously some kind of PDF download report, capture some data around that. And how are you going to communicate that as well in terms of, you can use a press release, or are you going to use a blog post and then drive people through it via Twitter? You know, how are you going to actually communicate that you've done this survey and what the findings were and the relevance, of course, again, to all those different markets? So there's a whole range of things you need to do. And obviously preparation is the most important thing, building up a press list. And this is another piece that I should have mentioned earlier, probably that SEO people need to consider, is they're going to arm themselves with the tools to know where this media is and how influential they are. So they can actually narrow down and make, you know, tiered, targeted media with, you know, to target their particular communications with. So you're talking about tools such as Gorkana or Cision, all these ones that you may well have heard of before.
And what they essentially are kind of, I suppose, it gives you a ready-made Rolodex of journalists. Is that kind of a fair way of sort of putting how they work?
Yeah, and they're reasonably up-to-date. Some are better than others. So you always know who's covering which particular beat. There's nothing worse for a journalist and being called up, say you're covering telecoms, and then someone calls up with a sports story. I mean, it just reflects badly on the PR company, and it kind of wastes journalist time, and that can end up nowadays in a bad tweet. So another problem that PR companies often do is a lot of the pitching to journalists is actually done by fairly junior team members, whose pitching skills aren't great, and obviously quite quite nervous on the phone when they're talking to journalists. So it's kind of like getting that right balance between a senior authoritative voice that really believes in the message when they call up, being able to communicate that effectively, that story to their journalists.
And I suppose that's something that the link builders might have as well, is that kind of concern that actually they're very comfortable pitching webmasters and maybe bloggers, but kind of less so kind of what they consider. Any advice on kind of dealing with that nervousness, Chris?
No, really. It's just down to personality, really. At the end of the day, no one's going to kill you down the end of the phone, are they? But it's kind of like, I think practice makes perfect, to be honest. I think like with anything, like when you started podcasting, I think if you listen back to it originally, you hadn't quite found your voice. Same as me when I started podcasting, and I look back, it's like I'm talking like from the BBC or something. But the end of the day, you just got to kind of be yourself, believe in what you're communicating. It is very difficult, and this, I think, is the acid test, really, when it comes to the newsworthiness of any particular piece. If you don't feel comfortable pitching it in, you don't feel it's a story, quite often it probably isn't. So it's kind of like spare yourself for the really good stories that when you know you're going to pick the phone up to a journalist, you can actually sit there with authority and go, look, I've got something really interesting for your readership. It's regarding X, Y, and Z, and what it means for them is X, Y, and Z. I think this would be a great piece of content for you, blah, blah, blah. Rather than a kind of like tenuous kind of, you know, half-witted story, half-baked that's rather self-serving and no good to anyone.
I think that's really good advice, Chris. That kind of, yeah, if you don't feel proud of that story, you don't feel that it's going to be something that they're going to want to write about, if you feel embarrassed by it, then actually that's not a good enough story. So another topic I wanted to talk to you about, Chris, was the recent release of Facebook Timelines for businesses. Now, kind of, it's quite a big change in the way that businesses sort of present themselves on Facebook. Is it kind of, do you think that it's got, how big an impact is it going to have on, you know, businesses and how they have to conduct their profiles on Facebook?
Yeah, just a quick bit of background then, just for those that kind of haven't heard of this already. I'll be astonished if you haven't. On the 30th of March, Facebook is enforcing its timeline for brands, similar to what you've had in an individual user of Facebook. You're going to have a totally new layout in a sort of a historical timeline format for your entire brand history. It is a massive thing for brands, especially those that have invested in, for example, landing pages, which are now going to be obsolete. So it's going to be a lot more resting on the actual visual aspect of what you put out there. It has also presents a fascinating set of opportunities for businesses as well, because they can be far more visual in their approach. They can also interact directly with fans, which is something that's been trialed in Asia, but it's actually the first time it's been used here. So that's the CRM issue there, I suppose. And also there's a number of other sort of presentation things. So I think that things like images are going to be far more important going forward. So should we sort of cover the main sort of
things
going to be going to change? So basically, when you launch your new page, as it will be once you've launched Timeline, you're going to need a cover sheet, which is a cover photo that sits across the top.
Yeah.
There are restrictions on the pixelation size of that, and you can't have any kind of promotional material in there, no calls to action, no nothing. Mm-hmm. So it's important to note that. Then you also got your profile picture, so with that's your brand logo or whatever. So really think about how you can illustrate your brand. It's going to take up the top half of a user's screen. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's really important. Then you've got just under that, you'll have a section saying about. So you've got a very limited sort of just a bit longer than a tweet's worth of words to really sell what your particular page is all about. And then you've got just four visible apps. Now, I used to have like apps on the left-hand side, you know, those tabs that you look at, and you do all sorts of different things with those, like competitions or whatever it happens to be. Here you're just going to have four, and then you'll have a drop-down menu which will offer you a number of others. I think it's a maximum of 12 or 16. But so if you've got a massive campaign, it's really important that you prioritize the four that you really want to focus on, because they're what people are going to see first when they land. So scrolling down, and you've got three other options of interest. One being pinning. So if you update things, you'll see on the timeline already, it goes this sort of left and right sort of feature. And on your sort of usual status update will be, you've got to think more about the visual element of it, because it's going to be far more eye-catching and far less wordy, whereas you've got the traditional wall stuff, you've got more left to right sort of situation. What you're going to see is a post on the left, which is your main post, and then on the right you're going to see other user activity. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's in the highlight setting. You'll see this when you scroll down. It'll see a little pop-up on the left-hand side that comes up.
Yeah.
But what you can do, things like pinning, highlighting, and milestones. These are big things. What pinning enables you to do is to keep something at the top. You know, traditionally on when you've posted
like
something
forums,
you post something on a wall, it goes to the top, and then next time someone updates, it goes down, or a user updates, it goes down and down. So you might have done a massive campaign, going back to our earlier piece about a survey, for example. You want it to sit there for a long time at front of mind, you know. So if you pin, it gets to sit there for 7 days before dropping down. So that gives you a chance to prioritize and sort of almost become a bit more of a publisher. It will give you more control as a publisher, I should say, than previously. Mm. What highlights do is enables you to expand that piece of content across the entire width of the page. So at the minute, you'll see most updates take up half the timeline. Now with highlights, which is a simple sort of option you get from the top right of any of your status updates, you click the star and it goes into the full width screen. So this you got to think about when it to using landscape over portrait type images, you know, and the sort of the words you're going to use. Milestones are important because of the timeline itself can go back as far as you set it. So it's important to get that right first time that you set it to the foundation of your company or whatever it happens to be that you want to go back to. If you look at people like Coca-Cola, for example, who were one of the early adopters of timeline, they're 40 and a half million followers.
Just a few.
Yeah. I mean, if you scroll down there, they've got a whole load of, you know, their historical data and a few old adverts and things like that going way back into the 70s and things like that. So you can get really retro. If you're a company with a heritage, then, you know, why not
take advantage
bring back some of those assets that people might be nostalgic about, you know. So there's plenty of opportunities as well. So when we're talking about having direct access, you can only direct message a fan if a fan has direct messaged you.
Okay.
So you can't actually spam them messaging, etc., which is good. Obviously, protects the user. But at the same time, it's really good because someone's got a query. You don't want that sitting on the wall going, oh, I hate my, you know, whatever system. It's not working. You guys haven't responded, blah, blah, blah. What you want to be able to do is just to sort of take that offline, really. And you can do that by encouraging them to direct message you and then following up offline, I guess. Mm. It's just like online PR as well, actually, you know. Customer relationship management, but so there's a lot of implications that the timeline has instigated for brands, and I think it's important for them to really understand it, get under the skin. You've got 2 weeks or so, well, you've got until the 30th of March, depending when this podcast goes out, as to you know, to deal with that and address it. But there's plenty of content out there that other people have written about. You know, the implications for brands. So I suggest anyone just Googles it and has a look and sees what other consultants are saying about timeline and address that as a matter of urgency.
Fantastic. No, it's a really big change. And I mean, fundamentally changes the way I think businesses are going to have to conduct themselves on Facebook in terms of how their presence and what it looks like. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see how that shakes out and some of the what the new conventions will become, if you know what I mean, because everyone does seem to be very much focused around that kind of big call to action landing page at the moment, and it seems that that might be going the way of the dodo.
Mm, no, totally, and what that means for design agencies is quite significant. Mm. You know, that's a lot of big part of their business maybe gone and have to free focus on other parts of Facebook.
Mm. Well, fantastic. I really appreciate that, Chris. And like I say, thanks again for the run through on what's coming up at your workshop at Brighton SEO. And yeah, thanks for talking as well about some of the big changes going on at Facebook.
Yeah, thank you, Kelvin. And if anyone wants to hear any more, planetcontent.co.uk.
Nice one. Cheers, mate. And we shall catch up anon.
Well, that's it for today. Thank you so much for listening. You can find us on the internet at www.internetmarketingpodcast.org, where you'll find show notes, links, and instructions on how to subscribe. We would absolutely love to get feedback, comments, and questions from you. If you want to send an email, send it to kelvin.newman@sitevisibility.com. Also, feel free to comment on the website. And if you'd like to use our voice line number, if you're outside of the UK, it's +44 1273 256 150. If you're inside the UK, it's 01273 256 150. And you can leave a voice comment or question and we'll play it on the show. Also, we would absolutely be delighted if you would give us a rating on iTunes itself. Well, that's it for now. Andy White signing off until next week on Internet Marketing.